Good morning. You're with A Big Country on ABC RN. I'm Serena Locke. This week, our team of rural reporters takes you to northern Tasmania, where edible native plants are making a comeback. Hazelnut growers harness the sun to dry their nuts. We go trackside for the Tower Hill picnic races and check out a shearing collection that's up for grabs.
I started at the end of 2001 because my professional shearing career was winding down. And I thought, well, I'd love to have a few things to commemorate what I've done.
There's about 250 of these signs in enamel, tin, paper.
Former shearer George Grant takes us for a walk through his collection before it's sold at auction. All that ahead on A Big Country today, but first to Tasmania, where Rhys Campbell is stocking up her larder.
So this is the first garden, okay? This is a southern garden, and it's got, this is the snowberry, which is, everybody knows about the snowberry, which is a beautiful fruit that grows. But the native violet has an edible flower. Ooh. Not particularly.
First taste.
Yep, but it makes the most beautiful violet jelly. It's absolutely exquisite. Mm.
Rhys Campbell is on a mission. She wants Tasmanians to embrace their island state's native edible plants and hopefully get them growing in their own backyards. Hello, I'm Margot Kelly. Rhys Campbell has an acre planted out in this garden in Wynyard in Tasmania's northwest. Already, there's more than 100 edible wild foods growing here.
And here's another one. Look at this. This is the creeping strawberry plum pine. And you, as you can see, this tiny little strawberry is growing on this pine. And the taste, again, is extraordinary. It is a combination of strawberries and pine. And this is where Tasmanian fruit is so valuable. It's a tiny fruit, but the amount of a flavour in such a minuscule fruit will spread out. So you could use that in a jar of jam made with apples or something, and the taste will go right through it.
All right, let's try.
Mm. Yeah, I know. It's amazing,
wow.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, and then a little bit peppery at the end.
Yeah, there's a lot of Tasmanian fruits have that astringency, that bite and astringency, which is one of the reasons where all those poison myths came in. Because it tastes like it's going to dry your mouth out, people think it must be poisonous. But very few of them are. This is our garden. We call it Murnong Wild Food Garden because we're planting all the edible Tasmanian plants here. We've got almost an acre in downtown Wynyard, and we've got over 100 edible Tasmanian native plants in here.
Edible? How nutritious?
The nutrition varies hugely. A lot of the fruits are not very nutritious. Tasmanian wild fruit lacks nutrition. A lot of it is just basically sugary water. But equally, a lot of the tuber plants and some of the others are quite highly nutritious. In fact, the Murnong, which is a species of daisy, of dandelion really, which was widespread all over southern Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia and here. And it was a staple carbohydrate of the first Australians. And within 30 years of white settlement, it was just about made extinct by sheep, by farming and by compaction of the soil. So that's why we call this Murnong. We're bringing that back.
While Indigenous Australians understood and used these wild foods, European settlers weren't so keen. There was a social stigma attached to eating these native plants and berries.
One of the reasons why we've lost the knowledge is because if you were white and ate bush food, you were poor, so you didn't report that. And if you were Aboriginal for a long time in Tasmania, that was a very negative thing to acknowledge. So you didn't acknowledge that Aboriginal heritage either. So you were caught between those two groups of people who did not want to acknowledge what they were actually eating.
And certainly it seems that in the colonial times, replicating what was done in Britain in this amiable climate in Tasmania was seen as the best way to move society forward rather than create a hybridised new Tasmanian approach to food.
Absolutely. Well, the Naturalisation Society did just that very early on. Within 30 or 40 years of white settlement in Tasmania, there were already hundreds of plants. Look at our blackberry, our hawthorn, our boxthorn. All of those were naturalised here within a very short time. So people went to some efforts to bring the blackberry over and the raspberry over to harvest instead of picking our own native raspberries.
Not content just to grow these edible plants, Rees transforms them into an array of jams, chutneys and preserves to show just how versatile they can be.
Yep, okay, so let's go to the kitchen. I'm here this morning. I've just made a jam from...
Lovely.
This is a jam made from Caprosma and crab apple, Bilardiera and Caprosma. So, yeah. That's the crab apples to go in the jelly. Okay, so we have here, these are dessert sauces with the, that's that tiny little berry I was talking to you about, the little currant berry. Lots of jams and chutneys, even pickled seaweed, pickled samphire. All sorts of things. There's a chutney made 80% from bull kelp. Yep.
Oh, I can't imagine that'd be too nice.
It's lovely. It's really lovely. It's an earthy, robust, beautiful chutney and fabulous for Tasmanians because of our iodine deficiency.
Mmm.
Something like good old lemon curd, but it's made with the lemon baronia as a flavouring as well as the lemon. And I was telling you about the native violet, the jelly from the native violet flower.
Oh, what a stunning colour as well.
Absolutely beautiful. So, yeah, lots and lots. And this sauce is a hot sauce.
Uh-oh.
You're not a hot person?
I am.
You are, yeah. Good. So it's a hot sauce with Tasmanian pepper and rigodia berries.
Okay. Oh, that's magnificent.
And you'll never taste that. That's a taste that is only a Tasmanian taste.
So what motivates you to keep going with this?
Because I think that people don't recognise the value of what's directly under our noses. I think that happens a lot with Tasmania full stop. But our botanical larder is fabulous. There's so much that we could be growing in our own gardens. Instead of putting agapanthus in, you know, which is toxic and horrible, we could be putting in some of our Tasmanian natives that are beautiful garden plants, have a wonderful bird-attracting habitat, and great to eat.
I like hazelnuts, and we import something like $12-15 million worth, so there was obviously a market for them. And I like the sort of climate that hazelnuts enjoy, so we get on quite well together.
And it's a partnership that's continued to grow. Hello. Michael Kavner with you in a hazelnut orchard near the town of Orange in the central west of New South Wales. Basil and Jean Baldwin planted out their first trees about 20 years ago and now have several thousand bearing fruit. Harvest has just finished for another year and the nuts are being dried and processed ready for sale. But there's nothing very high-tech about the process. The majority of their nuts are dried outside in the sun.
When we start our harvest, the nuts haven't been down on the ground for very long, so they really are quite moist. We do have a drying cabinet, but we're environmentally conscious people. Really, this is a very simple solar drying process. We just lay them out in the drying racks for several days, and we cover them at night with a tarpaulin there, take it off again in the morning, and they get lovely and warm. But it's not just their drying out. I think they cure. I think it affects the flavour. I think it helps the flavour develop nicely.
How do you determine that they're dry enough both for transport and also for taste?
I crack them with some nutcrackers and taste them. It's not very high tech, I'm sorry.
in tasting them though, you think they're okay.
Yes.
But then your wife Jean comes along. Does she have a different palate?
Not really, no. As long as they're nice and crunchy. As Basil says, they cure, but they continue to cure for 4 or 6 weeks after harvest, even when they're in storage. If you crack them too soon, they just haven't got that beautiful hazelnut flavour. They just need time after harvest to develop it.
Basil, you've got these drying on the trays, but you do have also drying facilities. Would you transfer these across, or do you use the drying facilities for other hazelnuts?
If we have cool weather and they don't dry enough, then they go into the drying cabinet. We've got some in there at the moment if you want to have a look.
Before we do though, is there still a difference in taste? Can you say these have been sun-dried and then you break open another one, you've got the blindfold on, and you can say, no, that's come from the drying machine?
The ones in the drying cabinet are the minority, and what we're trying to do is to get them into a condition which it makes them saleable. So they might not be perfect and as nice as we'd like them to be, but they will be, hopefully next week, able to be cracked and sold to those people who are crying out for hazelnuts.
Basil, we're now at the drying cabinet, and you'd probably describe them as a wardrobe that you'd find in a bedroom, double-doored, and inside there are a series of plastic trays stacked on each other and a temperature gauge. How does this operate?
At the back of here we have a small fan heater which is on low. It's blowing air through, and there is a hole in the top, so we've got air coming into the bottom, going through and taking the moisture out of the drying cabinet.
And when you want to test them, you just open the door, pull a tray out. And how do you actually test?
At the moment,
you're looking at the temperature gauge, but how do you then test a hazelnut?
By cracking it and tasting it.
So you've got a nutcracker in your hand.
I have.
The kernel's all broken up, and then you've got what people would normally view as a hazelnut ready for taste.
Yes, it's actually that's a nice big nut and the well-filled kernel. And if I taste it...
Now this is interesting, it's going from you've had half, and now Jean's going to. Now Jean, how does it taste?
It hasn't got its full flavour yet, and it isn't crunchy enough. It needs a few more days.
Now that's one view. Basil?
Same opinion.
Once the nuts are dried, they're ready for processing and grading. The Waldwins produce a range of value-added product on farm, including their own muesli, chocolate bars, and even a pancake mix.
This is our value-adding room, or our clean room, because we don't sell any nuts in shell. I refuse to sell any nuts in shell because you don't know what's inside the shell. Some of them are empty. Some of them have got mouldy nuts. So we sort them all out so everything that leaves here is top quality.
Have you noticed differences in the demographics? Who eats what?
A lot of our customers are from Europe because they're used to the hazelnuts. A lot of our mail order customers are Europeans.
Do they go the muesli path or the sweet tooth path?
No, they just want either raw or roasted kernels, just straight, and then they do whatever they do with them. Not many of them buy the products. They like to do their own.
What's your favourite way of eating a hazelnut?
That's a very hard question. I like everything we make.
You had to say that.
No, we eat the muesli every morning for breakfast and have done for many years. And yes, I think probably roasted nuts. They're our biggest seller and they're fantastic.
Hazelnut growers Jean and Basil Baldwin drying and processing their crop at their orchard near Orange in New South Wales. You're listening to A Big Country, still to come today. A shearing collection is up for sale. And after years of drought in Western Queensland, they're racing again at Tower Hill.
Official race starter Sam Brown drops the red flag and the horses head off into a cloud of dust. After a three-year hiatus due to drought, they're racing again at the Tower Hill Amateur Picnic Race Meeting in Western Queensland. Hello, I'm Andrea Crothers. I've joined a crowd of about 200 on Hillview Station, just north of the small town of Muttaburra, to cheer on the runners at this bush track. The Tower Hill Race Club dates back to 1909. It's one of the state's last grass-fed amateur race meetings and has strong ties to the local grazing community. Most of the horses and jockeys are locals. Even the race starter, Sam Brown, comes from a beef property near Prairie. He's been lining up the horses and jockeys, looking for a good, clean start across the track for the past 18 years.
It's quite a challenge. The
The jockeys might be small, but they're tricky little buggers. And it's taken me quite a few years to learn their little tricks, and I still don't think I've learned them all, but we seem to get them away reasonably well. A little bit of an adrenaline rush for a few seconds during the day, so it's a bit of fun.
What do you think of the jockeys this year?
They're behaving themselves really well. We've got a few green ones, a few that haven't ridden before, and they're doing really well. So hopefully we'll get through the day without any mishaps.
One of those jockeys is Dave Owens from Somerset Station near Longreach. He's a regular here at the Tower Hill race days and is following a family tradition of both riding and training horses for the event.
I've been racing here and riding horses at Tower Hill and the picnics around since 2000, so coming on 18 years, and maybe missed one with a broken bone or something.
So Dave, the Tower Hill races are back. How does it feel to be racing again?
Oh look, we've had a great day today. We've just had a small contingent of jockeys, good number of horses, not big. It's great to be back here. We've had 3 years off. It's been a big part of my life. My father rode here, so he trains now and I ride. So yeah, it is really exciting. We've had a really good little crowd here today. So very exciting to see the sport.
So your father trains here. He used to ride. So it's quite a family affair for you guys then, is it?
Oh, it's definitely a family affair. You look in the jockey's room, there's two other young people my age, a bit younger than me, riding for their parents, and they've got a horse of their own, as I have at times. So very much a family affair. So yeah, no, it is one big community for sure.
There's fierce competition amongst the jockeys to ride a winner on the day, and it's an especially personal battle for Dave Owens. You see, his girlfriend Amy McIntosh is also riding today. Just how serious does it get?
Oh, it's very serious. Amy, the president here, is my girlfriend. We don't talk much for 2 days. But even the other guys, we play it really safe, and that's the best part about what's happened today. We've had a new guy start today, a bit older, ridden before, but he's taking in his stride. Everyone looks after each other, and then they have a ball, and we do a lot of talking out there. Good times.
So what sort of preparation do you do to get ready for the races?
Oh, I've had a big prep. The old man made me go home 6 days in a gallop this year, but the last two race meetings I rode at, I rocked up and galloped the bloke's horses that I was riding for that year, and then I was just sore for the weekend. So I've had a big prep, 6 days, and probably as fit as I've been for 4 years.
Amy McIntosh and Dave Owens aren't just saddling up and riding at the Tower Hill race days. They're also on the race club committee, helping to keep these amateur picnic race meetings alive. Sam Brown says it's important the younger generation gets involved.
It's a credit to all the youngsters, and I think it'll be the saving of the club. All the young people have hooked in, and they have some ownership, and that's the way it needs to be. They need to step up, and I think they've done an absolute excellent job. Crowd are having fun. You can hear them cheering from the other side of the track, and that's what it's all about. Getting a winner.
Knock knock.
Hello.
Hi, George.
Yes. How are you, Jess?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Nice
good.
To meet you.
Jess, we'll go over the museum if you like.
You got time for a quick look around?
I've got time for a long look around.
Yeah.
When George Grant retired as a shearer back in 2011, he couldn't quite let go of his life in the sheds. He started collecting a few things related to sheep and shearing, and now there's hundreds, if not thousands, of items stored in this shed at Warwicknabeal in southwest Victoria.
These little critters down here are quite valuable, brass ones, ear taggers, lots of boxes. Those boxes are from overseas.
But not for much longer.
Books.
Hello, I'm Jess Davis. After more than a decade, George is selling the lot.
Righto, well, all of this, as you can see here, Jess, is all going to be sold. There's miles and miles of books, miles of collectibles. All these sorts of things are very important if you're, you know, if you're into history and stuff, and if you're restoring. Over here, some very interesting old hand pieces, some beautiful old brass ones from the early 1890s.
I started at the end of 2001 because my professional shearing career was winding down. And I thought, well, I'd love to have a few things to commemorate what I've done.
Heaps and heaps of boxes of little collectibles, all sorts of things to do with sheep shearing, combs and cutters and booklets, heaps of booklets, tally books, all very nice to have if you're a collector.
Started in the sheds in 1967, rousebouting. Took me a couple of years to get going. I rousebouted for a while and was on the wool press, and I spent my 21st birthday on the wool press at White Cliffs in New South Wales, pressing for 6 shearers. At the end of 1970, that year was 1970, end of that year, I got a job learner shearing at Will Canyon with Bill Blake, and took me a couple of years really to properly get going, and I've been going ever since. I have done other work, but shearing has been my love the whole time.
What is it you love about shearing?
I think it's the freedom that you can go all over Australia and all the world, and for an ordinary working person, what other job can you do that? And the added bonus is you make really good money as well.
We get onto some of these signs, and these have mostly come from the United Kingdom and very, very sought after. You won't get that McDougall sheep dip one there. You probably won't get a better condition one than that.
George Grant's love of shearing memorabilia is obvious as we walk around the shed. The walls are stacked with advertising signage for old wool broking firms and sheep dips.
There's about 250 of these signs in enamel, tin, paper, and
there's shearing blades and wool presses, even a pair of oversized hand clippers, about half a metre long. And it's not just Australian shearing gear he's been interested in collecting.
And here's a wooden brand where, as you can see, it's got a swastika symbol on it. And whilst I acknowledge the unfortunate history of the swastika, very unusual pre-World War I and came from the Bort region. The hand-turned operated shearing plants. And they call these a husband and wife model because guess what the wife did? She was doing the turning, and to make these work, you had to wind them extremely hard. They were very big in America and in England, but in Australia, when these were used in the early 1900s, we had mobs of sheep in Australia that were up to 100,000 sheep. And in the 1890s, the biggest was about 320,000 sheep. So I can't imagine wearing away at one of these.
What about these big clippers here?
Yeah, well, the oversized clippers, they were made in 2003 to commemorate the year of the Outback. And I quite often tell people, the sheep were that big when I started, we had to use these things to get the wool off.
So what is it that you like about the collecting then?
Well, I like the fact that it commemorates what I've done. But for me, I love the signage, and because it's artistic, I've done a bit of art in, you know, my early days, and I just love the appeal that signs give. And when you see all these signs that are on the floor now, I had a shed where I previously lived in the same size as this, and they were just absolutely everywhere. People would come in and their eyes would pop out nearly. Yeah.
What's your favourite sign?
I have many favourites. I think there's one sign here, I've actually got it covered up at the moment. It's advertising one of my antique hand-turned plants. And it's a beautiful, decorative, artistic thing. It's just gorgeous.
Now, you're giving it all up. You're selling your collection. Why?
Well, it's probably time. Sometimes I'm living on my own here at Warringabeel, and I'm always a bit scared that when I go away, that, you know, someone will break into the shed and I might have, you know, my really nice pieces might be gone. And I spoke to my daughter, my eldest daughter, who... she'll look after things if anything happens to me. And she said, Dad, I wouldn't know where to start. And, you know, so I thought, right, okay, now's the time. I'll just free up a bit of my time and just travel a bit.
Is it going to be hard losing it all?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, because I won't be able to wander over the shed and see it all. But no, because then I'll have freedom and I'll obviously have a few dollars in my pocket and I can just travel around, visit my family a bit more, visit friends.
Are you going to keep some of your favourite bits, though?
No, I'm not. No, no.
Not a single piece?
No, I don't think I'll keep anything because other collectors will enjoy it as I have. And so I thought, well, I might as well sell it all. It's an emotional thing when you gather them and you look at them and you can say, OK, I've been to that place or I've enjoyed the company of people in a certain area and I've worked for that particular company and et cetera, et cetera, and you've got an association with it. I don't know any other job where you can be so passionate about it. It is a way of life. I'll miss that. I don't shear now and I'll miss it already, you know, so I just don't know how I'm going to go in the future. But, you know, life takes turns, doesn't it?
Former shearer and collector George Grant, looking forward to some new adventures. And if you're interested in seeing some of those pictures, especially the giant hand shears, then go online to abc.net.au/radionational. Our reporter Jess Davis has posted a great feature story there. That's A Big Country for this week. I'm Serena Locke on ABC RN.